Well, I find that quite congenial. And the band Radiohead, a cut above your average rock band. It's a favourite of my next guest, as I promised you, the music critic for The New Yorker, Alex Ross. Alex's latest book is Listen to This, wherein Radiohead jostles for space with Mozart, Brahms and Bob Dylan. I became a fan of Alex Ross some years ago, not that long ago, when he wrote a book called The Rest Is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. I bought an audio book version of it, and it was kept me company on many of my long, endless nocturnal drives, because I really don't know an awful lot about music. All I ever hear are Stings. So I'm delighted that he's on the program to talk about his new book, Listen to This. It's a runaway bestseller, and he's a pretty clever bloke. Alex is here on tour with the Australian Chamber Orchestra. In fact, he's curated two separate concert programs using music associated with his two books, and he gives a pre-concert talk before each performance, and I reckon that's a terrific idea. I really do. I'd go to more concerts if someone stood up at the front and explained them to me. Alex joins us from our Melbourne studios. Welcome to our little wireless program, Alex, and I hope the acoustics are good enough for you.
Excellent. Thank you, Philip. It's great to be on the show.
Well, you begin your latest effort, listen to this, with a rather provocative sentence. Let me remind you, writing about music isn't especially difficult. Well, I think all writing is difficult, but surely writing about music must be doubly difficult for at least two reasons. One, because music is abstract, and the other because we've tended to abandon education, musical education, pretty much in our public schools.
Well, yes. I mean, I'm being a little playful because I know that it is exceptionally difficult. And I think, you know, what you mentioned there, education and sort of figuring out, well, how much does my reader know about what I'm talking about, it is very tricky. And, you know, on the one hand, I have some readers who are terribly expert on the subject and will write angry emails if I get something even slightly wrong about, you know, Mozart or Benjamin Britten or whomever I'm writing about. And then there's another reader, perfectly intelligent chap, you know, has studied literature in college and knows the, you know, history of painting and goes to see art films, but may know absolutely nothing about this particular composer because classical music is just not on the menu of so many people's education. So that's always something I have to negotiate.
You must have been pleased and astonished with the response to your first effort, The Rest Is Noise.
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah. Not a tiny tome by any means. 700 pages, and we both thought everyone was supposed to hate 20th century classical music, and yet you were a blockbuster success.
Yeah, well, I was astonished. I mean, of course, I sort of idly dreamed of something like this happening, but really, I mean, as with so many authors, my main objective was, you know, not to disappear without a trace and create an embarrassment for my publisher. You know, I just wanted to sell, you know, a few copies here and there. You know, anything beyond that was just a sort of a wild dream. And it did seem to really engage with a much wider readership. And I think a lot of that has to do with the subject matter. I mean, I think I had sort of landed upon some extraordinarily dramatic material, you know, the lives of these composers, how they intersected with, you know, some of the most violent events of the 20th century and some of the most violent personalities.
But that's where you cut through, because you contextualize music. We'll get into some of it later, you know, the political significances and interactions. Were you aware that an aging broadcaster, did a little light come on when I bought a copy? Did you see a little light come on? And here's this decrepit old fella driving his velocipede through the night listening to your audiobook.
No, I wasn't informed. Our technology is lagging a little behind.
Indeed.
But it's a wonderful image now that I have it. My next book that I write, I'll picture you driving through the outback.
Well, mate, I found it very spiritually nourishing. At one point, you talk about a Hungarian composer, George Ligeti, yeah?
Yes, George Ligeti. Yeah.
Yeah, who was famous for some of his music used in A Space Odyssey. And he was haunted in his final years by the idea that he would be forgotten after his death. I think a future that faces almost all of us.
Yes.
And that he had outlived the age in which music mattered. Was he right?
He was wrong, I think. You know, and I think this is a common fear that haunts many creative people. You know, they feel, you know, they've had the acclaim, and they've seen sort of tangible evidence that you know they've had a great impact culturally. But they wonder, you know, are they going to, you know, disappear in future years? And we don't know, of course. We don't know what people 100 years from now will be listening to. But Ligeti, you know, I think especially since his death, is played more than ever, and it's music that is exceedingly complicated in construction, but it has this presence. It just has a kind of a physicality when you're in the hall listening to it. It just has tremendous impact. It has wit. It has a sort of irony and a sort of layer upon layer of reference, and it has a kind of a wonder. I mean, those pieces that Kubrick used in 2001 just sort of send chills down your spine because they, you know, he wasn't thinking of outer space when he wrote them, but they have that capacity to disclose other worlds, and this is one great capacity that music possesses.
How sad that he's not around to enjoy his post-mortem success. A frequent guest on this program over the years has been Gore Vidal, who always talks about the end of the novel, the death of literature. I think he's sort of extrapolating from his own vast age, but people have been predicting the death of classical music for quite a while, have they not?
Yes, it really goes back hundreds of years. The first biography of Bach, published around 1800, essentially implied that music, the history of music, was then coming to an end, and sort of Bach was the last master, and after that it was just going to be sort of silly Italian opera or whatever the author had in mind. And, you know, of course, there was a lot more that happened after that. And at regular intervals, we've had predictions of the death of classical music, and certainly as the 20th century has gone on, there's been the sense that the music has been shoved to the side, as has become increasingly marginal in a cultural sense.
And but that happened in jazz as well, to a large extent.
Oh yes, absolutely, yes, and I think, you know, so many of these cultural forms, I don't really like to use words like high and serious and sort of art music, because, you know, there's so much pop music which is very serious but it's a struggle, you know, to get attention in this popular culture. But there's a flip side to this, in that in some ways, the audience for classical music is bigger than it has been at any time in history. You know, in Mozart's time, really a few thousand people knew his music in select halls, usually aristocratic settings. You know, now millions of people tune in to listen to you know, major orchestras on the radio, and, you know, can buy recordings, watch on the internet, and, you know, if you think about the vast new audiences for classical music in East Asia, and those people were not listening to this music 100 years ago, and so it's become a global enterprise.
But is it not true that there's been a collapse of the classical recording industry?
Well, that's true, but there's been a collapse of every kind of recording, of course. I mean, in pop as well, and you have so many institutions now, performing organizations, making their own recordings. I mean, the technology has almost made it unnecessary to have an established major label making recordings for you. I mean, you can just sort of set up some microphones and make a very good sounding, you know, digital recording yourself, and then issue it, put it out on the internet, sell it, you know, at the concert. And so it's sad to see the decline of this great old tradition of studio recording, but the technology has also enabled many new ways of spreading the news about the music.
Alex, forgive me for asking this. It's just out of left field, because it suddenly occurred to me. And you'd related to the great founder of The New Yorker, Harold Ross?
Oh, no, I'm not. Nor to Lillian Ross, our wonderful longtime writer. But
yes,
as far as I know, I mean, I guess sometime back in the earlier centuries, these Rosses may have intersected in Scotland, but
okay.
Not that I know of.
I was going to accuse you of nepotism, but I can't do that now. And in fact, wouldn't dream of it. Now, it's fair to say that some of classical music's best friends have been its worst enemies. I don't mean Adolf Hitler, we'll come to him later. But in your writing, you always attempt to place music in its social, political, historic context. Mm. Isn't it true that many classical music buffs have tended to be enormous snobs, that they've mystified music, treated it like it has no political or social context?
Yeah, and that has been a difficulty, I think. And you know, I was once one of these people, absolutely. I mean, when I was growing up, I was a freakish sort of kid who listened exclusively to music written between 1750 and 1900, and I dismissed everything else as rubbish, you know, including, obviously, the entirety of pop music, which made me enormously popular in school, as you can imagine. And it comes from the love of the music. I mean, when you talk about sort of the classical music snob, these are people who are just deeply, deeply devoted to this stuff. And you know,
I withdraw the word, Alex. But
no, but you're absolutely onto something, because you know their love of the music can turn into this sort of a kind of a didacticism, or you know, condescension, and it can, you know, become a little nasty when you're in the concert hall and someone is applauding in the wrong place, quote unquote, after the big first movement of a romantic piano concerto, and the person, you know, or someone across the other side of the hall, you know, this kind of behavior, and that's just wrong. I mean, first of all, because there is really no right or wrong when it comes to this matter of applause at concerts. I mean, I really think that audiences should decide for themselves when to applaud and when not to. And of course, in the 19th century, there was constant applause.
I advocate the Zen response, the sound of one hand clapping. I think that's you know, can be enthusiastic, but it doesn't distract other people.
Yeah. Well, you have to think about that. But you know, I just, you know, if you're shushing people, then actually you're making your own kind of noise and just sort of adding to the din. So it's not a particularly constructive approach.
But in your introductions to the concerts here, are you telling people they may applaud at will?
No, I'm not really bringing up that subject. Ironically, actually, the idea that we came up with for one half of one of the concerts was to ask people not to applaud at all until it was over. But we're striving for a particular kind of effect. We're playing three pieces from the 20th century in sequence, and they seem to add up to something bigger. This early 20th century music by Webern, which is full of foreboding, a beautiful but very ominous piece on the border between tonality and atonality. And then we have this piece by Xenakis, the Greek avant-garde composer, which is an explosion, a frightening work in many ways. And then at the end, we have Richard Strauss' Metamorphosen, which is a lamentation. And I thought of it as sort of a picture of the 20th century itself, foreboding, yeah, the explosion and the lamentation. And so I thought it would be nice if we saved the applause till the end. But if people disagree and want to applaud, I'm not going to be upset.
some of the listeners will be attending your concerts, but I do urge them just to clap with one hand. Alex, there are, of course, music provides a soundtrack in a way for literature, which would be recording the same sort of transitions, and certainly the visual arts.
Yes, I mean, these kinds of relationships fascinate me because, you know, I fell in love with 20th century music in college at the same time I was devouring the great modernist writers and becoming aware of what was happening in painting and film. And it all sort of flowed together, and I was fascinated by the connections among all these artists. So I do oppose the idea that music is some pure, absolutely abstract autonomous language mm. with no connections to the outside culture. And there's so much evidence against that assumption. And look at all the collaborations that Stravinsky launched into, with Nijinsky and Balanchine and with Picasso and with W.H. Auden. I mean, he was a man who was so avid for these kinds of cross-disciplinary collaboration.
And the others were avid for him, weren't they? I mean,
It was nice. Stravinsky was the hippest man of the age in so many ways. as I point out in the book, this is a man who gave his autograph to both Frank Sinatra and the Pope. And the other great story is when he met the Kennedys, he went over for dinner and had a little too much to drink and started bothering the president about his tax problems. And then
You're kidding.
He was sort of carried out. He was sort of to the limousine. And afterward, as they were driving home, he turned to his wife and said, "Nice kids." That was Stravinsky.
Oh, dear. Let's go back to Hitler. I'm sorry to, but we must. Now, the music of Wagner, permanently associated with anti-Semitism, and not entirely Hitler's fault, but one of the most interesting arguments in your book is that post-war period classical music, in general, has been discredited, has lost its moral authority because of the use Hitler made of it.
I think there's something to this. I mean, I wrote that with some trepidation because it's a speculation and something you just can't possibly prove or really disprove. It's a sort of a hunch that I have. But to sort of seeing all these films where there's some kind of sadistic person about to do something terribly bloody, like Hannibal Lecter, and he unwinds by listening to Bach, to Goldberg Variations, or some other horrible, destructive CEO of some company is shown, listening to opera before he goes out and destroys everyone's lives. There's scene after scene where classical music is tied, not only to the elite, to the wealthy, to the upper classes, but to evil, to people of with that sort of will to destroy. And I think Hitler must have something to do with that. And it's just so implanted.
Well, we know, of course, that there were pitiful orchestras in the death camps. There were people playing the bloody piano.
Yes, well, but the same music, classical music, was also a focus of resistance, and those orchestras really allowed people to stay alive. I tell the story of a relative of Gustav Mahler, who was leading the women's orchestra in Auschwitz, and she was strict in the Mahlerian fashion, and became terribly incensed if there was sort of one wrong note. But that concentration on the music actually helped some people to stay sane. Music landed on all sides of this conflict. I mean, Beethoven was used as a symbol by the Soviets, the Americans, and the Nazis and the English. Toscanini staged all Wagner concerts in New York during the war because he loved Wagner, he hated fascism, and he wanted to divorce Wagner from the fascists. And there is a great deal of Wagner actually that has nothing to do with fascism, which opposes fascism. Wagner was an anti-Semite, but he was also an avid individualist. He hated the organized state, and he was just a man of so many views that ran contrary to the fascist world view. And his masterpiece, The Ring Cycle, is a critique of power. It is a tale of a man, Wotan, the chief of the gods, realizing how powerless he is and how many mistakes he has made in trying to assert his power. And so it's sometimes difficult to understand, exactly how much Hitler was really understanding this music that he professed to love.
We mentioned Kubrick earlier, and one of the things I liked about Stanley's scores were often their irony and wit. So you get a Strauss waltz in the Space Odyssey accompanying, epic shots of spacecraft, or you get, was it Happy Days Are Here Again or Blue Skies, Where Are They Gone, accompanying the nuclear explosions and Strange Love. That's an interesting way to conjoin music with images, isn't it?
Yes, I think it goes back to the 20s, to some of the early Bolshevik theorists who wanted the music to deconstruct, to sort of tug against the image on the screen, but it doesn't need to have a sort of a political ideology attached to it. It's just a very powerful technique, I think, and I'm fascinated by good film music and also good choices of music, sort of extant music in film.
What about stuff that's specially scored? One of my favorite film scores is Prokofiev's score for Nevsky.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's a masterpiece. And this is a case of, you know, a great collaboration between a director and a composer, where Eisenstein, in some cases, had Prokofiev write the music first and then edited the film, you know, even sort of supervised the filming itself to the tempos of the music, because he knew how powerful this component of the whole project would be.
Yeah.
And, you know, now, of course, in the sort of Hollywood system, the music is sort of pasted in at the very last moment, and there are very few directors who have the forethought to really plan the music at a much earlier stage.
2011, centenary of Gustav Mahler's death. And incidentally, had you come out a few years ago, you could have met the prime minister who lives for Mahler,
in
Paul Keating. And there will be all sorts of celebrations and concerts going on. You are, I am told, something of a Mahler nut, like Paul Keating.
To some extent, yeah. I mean, sometime in high school, I really dove into the world of Mahler and became obsessed with listening to the symphonies and studying the scores and collecting different recordings. Maybe the enthusiasm has quieted down a little bit. I'm just, you know, I'm still deeply devoted to Mahler, but, you know, not quite at that fanatical level. But he's an extraordinary, just sort of overwhelmingly human composer. I mean, the music is so suffused with every imaginable emotion, and the emotions are changing from instant to instant.
Much so that even Hitler was a fan, wasn't he? Living in Vienna before the First World War, he was a keen admirer.
Well, he admired, and this is on the basis of just a few shreds of evidence, but he seems to have admired Mahler's conducting.
Oh, I see. Conducting rather than composition.
Conducting of Wagner in particular, but okay. There's no evidence that he actually heard Mahler's music, and he probably would not have responded to it because...
Well, I find I'm relieved to be correct.
Yes, because of those layers of irony and the sarcasm in Mahler, and the obvious references to Jewish musical tradition, especially in the First Symphony, the famous scherzo of the First Symphony. I think Hitler might have really run in the opposite direction from that music.
Although I don't think of Hitler as having a gift for irony, but let's not dwell on him. Now Mahler must be, well, on the short list of the most popular 20th century composers.
Yeah, it's a great transformation, and it's a lesson in how music that at one time was dismissed as discordant and chaotic and, you know, beyond the bounds of serious and sober classical composition is now absolutely central to the tradition. I mean, you know, orchestras know if you put on a Mahler symphony, it's going to sell very well. You have to hire a lot of extra musicians in many cases, so it's, financially it may all balance out. But he has really moved from a marginal position in the repertory right to the center, and I think we see this happening with more and more of these once controversial 20th century figures. You know, Shostakovich is now a very mainstream composer. Prokofiev, of course, has been popular for many decades. And even Ligeti and you know, there are even moments where Stockhausen is achieving more popularity. Yes, well, you know, it's spectacular music. It's loud and psychedelic, and it definitely does appeal to one portion of the public, if not to some of the, you know, old time classical subscribers.
My dear listeners, we're having a lovely time with Alex Ross, music critic of The New Yorker, author of The Rest Is Noise, which I commend to you, and The Newie. Listen to this, and this is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and all over the planet via all those tricky new technologies which I but dimly comprehend. Now, Alex, you're touring with the Australian Chamber Orchestra. You've created two separate concert programs. The one that I find most intriguing to think about is the one that pivots around classical music in 1945 at the end of the Second World War. And it's clearly a profoundly important transitional moment.
Yes, well, this was the year that the Germans sometimes call Year Zero, the year in which everything came to an end and then began again. And it was actually only after I'd assembled the pieces that I realized how crucial this year 1945 was to each of the composers. You know, I wanted to end with Metamorphosen, that lamentation by the elderly Richard Strauss that I mentioned before.
We'll play a bit of that shortly.
And I wanted to sort of capture different sides of the 20th century, not just sort of the dissonant avant-garde century, which is represented by Xenakis and also Anton Webern, but also it was also a century of great lyricism and of deep reflection upon the musical past. And you hear that in Benjamin Britten's beautiful and playful and brilliant variations on a theme of Frank Bridge. And there's this wonderful piece by Toru Takemitsu, the late 20th century Japanese composer, Nostalgia, which is named after the great film by Tarkovsky and is a memorial to Tarkovsky. And this is a mysterious piece steeped in French influences as well as some of that early 20th century Austrian music. And then Stravinsky's Apollo, the final movement of his great ballet, which is music of astonishing purity, kind of a crystalline vision of Apollo being deified. But then beyond that, I mean, if I just suddenly realized, well, where were all these composers in 1945? Takemitsu was a teenage soldier sort of imprisoned in this underground mountain fortress in Japan. Britten was a conscientious objector, a pacifist, who had written this masterpiece, this new operatic
Peter
masterpiece.
Peter Grimes,
yeah. A tale of violence begetting violence, and that was about to have its premiere later in 1945. Stravinsky was in Hollywood, in this surreal situation, living in this totally different Californian world, but sort of watching the war unfold from afar. The most
Korngold was there, of course, wasn't he?
Yeah, writing for
Hollywood.
And Stravinsky had his flirtation with sort of trying to write film music, but he asked for too much money and didn't work out. But the most startling cases are, Webern had only a few months to live because he would be shot by an occupying American soldier. Accidentally.
You see, you're good at these, Alex. You're good at these extraordinary anecdotes.
Being
shot dead is an anecdote, but I had no idea that had happened.
Yeah, a tragic incident, and this poor kid, this soldier, he was just a cook, and he went on to have a sort of a horrible alcoholic life and died young, and I think never really realized who this man was, Webern, this esoteric, brilliant student of Schoenberg, whom he had shot, but he was troubled by what he had done. And Xenakis, this is the most extraordinary story. He was fighting in the Greek communist resistance, and right at the end of 1944, a British shell exploded almost in his face. The British, of course, had gone from fighting the Nazis to fighting the communists at this point. point. Half his face was torn away. One of his eyes was destroyed. For months and months, he was recovering. And then he had to leave Greece. A price was on his head. He ended up in Paris. He joined the studio of Le Corbusier, and he also studied composition with Olivier Messiaen and started this double career as an architect and composer. And he's a fascinating figure, and this is going to be the toughest piece in the program for a lot of people. It's only a few minutes long, but it's very intense. It's shocking, but it has a great, great visceral energy to it. It's a phenomenon, and sort of worth confronting and sort of living through. And then you have the great lamenting expanse of Strauss to follow.
Well, let's listen to this extraordinary piece of Richard Strauss, written for 23 string instruments, a lament for all the death and bombed out opera houses. Music Maestro. Well, to my untrained ear, that sounds absolutely grief-stricken. And yet here's Strauss identified with the Nazis. His career doesn't do too well because of it. But as you point out, that's not entirely fair to him. It's not fair to him at all.
Well, it's a very complicated case. You know, Richard Strauss was in it for himself. It's hard to sort of put too good a spin on his career in Nazi Germany. He was opportunistic. He wanted to use his position of cultural power really to advance the cause of his own music. He did not like the Nazis at heart. He did not like Hitler. He liked the idea of some kind of authoritarian regime that would take over art and sort of demand that quote-unquote serious classical music be played all the time. And that was sort of the goal he had in mind. And he was terribly disappointed. His son married a Jewish woman, and he was terribly devoted to his grandsons. And essentially, those grandsons were threatened with deportation, and that threat was made quite explicit to him as the 30s went into the 40s, and so there was a gun held to his head to some extent, and you can use that to excuse some of his behavior, but still, in the end, it's a disappointing story. But the grief here is real. It is a lament for the destruction of a national tradition, which is not the nationalism of Hitler. It's the great Germany of Beethoven and Goethe, and he sees it being carried to its grave, and that is made literal in this very chilling quotation from Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, the Funeral March, right at the end. And then we just seem to go into deepest, darkest night. Mm-hmm. And so this program will end on a very dark note. But, it's about to, the whole story is about to begin again. These young composers about to write this new music, and there's going to be avant-garde music, and then there's going to be a swing back to simplicity with minimalism, and the story of music is still unfolding. So this is definitely not the end of the story, but it's the end of one story.
Let me go back pre-war, because this is something else that I hadn't realized until I read your stuff, and that's by the late 1930s in the USA. There was a battalion, your word, of composers associated with Roosevelt's New Deal. Now, I knew about the way New Deal impacted on theatre and fiction, but I didn't realise that it had also produced or provoked the likes of Copland, Roger Sessions, Samuel Barber, Morton Gould, and so on. So it was a moment of great promise for American 20th century music. Is that promise still alive and kicking?
Well, there's still thousands of composers in America writing music, and some very good ones. So in that sense, the story is still alive and well. But the dream that Copland and many others had in the 30s, that the government itself could really step in and help them. And this idea that there could be a federal arts project, supporting the arts in so many different ways. I mean, this is obviously a story which has come to almost nothing. I mean, we have shockingly little support for the arts in the U.S.
We're much better than you at that, I must say. Although these days, ours is diminishing.
Almost every country in the world is better. The budget of the National Endowment for the Arts, which is about to be slashed, is $160 million. People spend $160 million on one political campaign these days. They spend it on that amount of money on one movie.
Yeah, well, much more.
Yeah, sure. And this is the entire budget for the arts in America. So it's sad.
But you see signs of hope here and there. In your latest, there's a lovely little piece about a visit you made to the Malcolm X Shabazz High School in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And you find a charismatic teacher succeeding in getting young black kids interested in classical music. How?
Well, this is how it works now. You have these teachers scattered around who just end up using their own resources. I mean, this wonderful man, Hassan Ralph Williams at the Malcolm X Shabazz School, was paying for things out of his own pocket. I think I ended up not mentioning some of this in the piece because he didn't want me to. But, this very talented young trumpeter, he bought him the trumpet. He was paying for other instruments in the school. He was, financing trips to camps and so on. And this is the story. The budgets are so small and the teachers end up really sacrificing their own time and their own money to keep things going.
They can get a response.
Yes.
From young kids in the U.S.
Yes, and then the support may come later when the results are evident and when someone extraordinary like that really starts to have an effect. But it's so random. I mean, there's so many other schools that have no one like that and almost no music program or arts program, and it's a terribly sad thing because the arts expand people's horizons, and even if they don't end up pursuing music or any other artistic field, something may change in their mind, and it may give them a new sense of possibility and a new sense of self. And I think it's just so important.
Alex, I love old media, which is why I sort of still write columns for newspapers, full old fool that I am, and it's why I like wireless, sitting here in a dark studio chatting to interesting people like you. And I regard television as a transition. It'll go, and the computer is clearly the devil's tool. But you see a great hope in the iPod for music.
Yes.
You sound like Rupert Murdoch seeing great hope for the iPod for newspapers.
Yeah, I wrote that a few years ago. I mean, I sometimes wonder, the internet was so exciting when it came along, and then you see more and more of the dark side of it as the years go by. But I still believe it is a great tool for spreading the news about, I think, especially some of the most esoteric and marginal music. A composer in Alaska who's writing some very strange and far out stuff, like John Luther Adams, whom I write about in this book, can start to find an audience around the world through the internet, through this amazing ability of the medium to sort of instantly broadcast something, halfway around the world. And that's extraordinary. And so, as with any technology, it can be used for good or ill, and we'll just sort of have to hope that the good wins out.
Well, you're pretty extraordinary yourself, Alex. Thanks for coming on. And let me tell the listener, whose name is Gladys, so if you meet the listener, just say hello, Gladys, that Alex will be with the Australian Chamber Orchestra in Adelaide tomorrow night. That's tonight if you're listening to the repeat. Perth on Wednesday, from whence I have just returned. Sydney at the weekend and during the following week. So with Alex's preamble and the music, you'll have a terrific time. That's a wrap from our little wireless program. Thanks for listening. We're going to play some music of our own, actually. This is something I composed. I pretend Elena Katz-Turner did it, but it's really an original work by me. And listen to the news.